Welcome to Enjoy Exceptional Living. I am Lynn Fritz, your program producer and host. This program is in collaboration with Enjoy Magazine, KKRN 88.5 FM Community Radio, and myself. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist. In each of our programs, our intention is to bring to our listeners the best of people, places, and projects of Northern California that we think you're going to enjoy and that we think are exceptional. Today I have in the studio an individual, Shasta County District Attorney's Office, Chief District Attorney Investigator, Alex Houston. Welcome.
Hey, thank you.
It's so good to have you here because in a recent experience, I was talking with someone at the District Attorney's Office and they mentioned investigation. I went, hey, that's a segment of law enforcement that I hadn't thought about. So that's why I chased you down and asked you to come in. I'd like you to, for the public to get to know what you're up to because it's kind of invisible in some ways or maybe overlooked. Because we don't usually typically see you like we'd see a deputy sheriff or a marshal in court, RPD officer.
Yeah, we're you know, not out there in the public very much or easily recognizable. A lot of times we're not wearing like a uniform. We have uniforms, but typically we'll wear those when we're like serving a search warrant or assisting another agency with an operation or conducting our own operation. So a lot of times we're the guys and gals wearing shirts and ties or business attire, and sometimes our equipment and badges are concealed. So I appreciate the opportunity to, you know, provide some light on what the District Attorney Bureau of Investigation does for Shasta County, and I'd be happy to explain any questions you have.
I would love that. And so let's start off with what would you say is the role of the investigators?
Well, we in the Bureau, we are... have a large portion of sworn law enforcement investigators. And with that, we have the arresting authority throughout the entire state of California and the jurisdiction specific for Shasta County for enforcing any sort of criminal violations as well as other violations. So we conduct day-to-day police protection, maintenance of order type stuff, but a majority of our work consists of providing independent investigations and assisting our prosecutors with supporting them when they go to trial or prior to trial, conducting those follow-up investigations, finding additional evidence if there is evidence out there or collecting it, and then assisting them with, you know, various types of trial support or cases going forward.
And so that would be with criminal cases?
With criminal cases. We actually split... We have a section working like welfare fraud, in-home health care, the EBT trafficking, or cases where people are providing like or getting CalFresh, CalWORKs government assistance, and then maybe reporting things differently, getting different amounts, or using the funds for not the intended purpose. So we have investigators that provide community outreach, education, and then also, you know, enforcement or collecting facts for Health and Human Services or various grant-funded different positions, different agencies throughout the state and throughout the county.
So that's good to know because I guess I was thinking of just criminal investigation. Well, it could be criminal, but you're really out there in a much broader spectrum than I realized. So I think that's good. How many are there in your department?
We have 30, approximately, well, let's see, we have 30 positions. We have a few vacancies. Uh-huh. So roughly with the sworn law enforcement officers or investigators, we have 15. And then we also have an additional 4 part-time sworn law enforcement investigators that assist us, you know, with the different programs or whatever our needs are. And then in addition to that, we have 7 investigative technician positions. So those are non-sworn positions. They do receive a lot of training within, you know, their area that they work or they practice in. We also have 2 investigative analysts that are non-sworn and then 2 process servers. Those groups of 4 people, the investigative analysts and the process servers, are all former law enforcement officers that retired that came back to work as retired and knew it. And so they've got a lot of experience, but their specific roles might be like backgrounds or providing support for policies and procedures manuals or updates or other special investigations we ask them to dig into, you know, areas that they're comfortable with.
Yeah. So when you use the term sworn authority, what does that mean?
So sworn as far as having like peace officer arrest powers, 830.1 of the penal code, the California Penal Code, is what gives us the legal authority. So we have the same, the sworn investigators have the same authority as like a municipal police officer, like a Reading police officer, a deputy sheriff, marshal, deputy marshal, or other, you know, sworn law enforcement positions within the state of California. Our arresting authority, you know, has, we have arresting authority throughout the entire state, but our law enforcement jurisdiction for investigating cases is local to Shasta County.
Shasta County. Yeah. Do you ever get called to support other counties, or is that just their jobs?
We do, yeah. Okay. On occasion, I say the most recent would be the wildfires. So we'll occasionally get a mutual aid request from other agencies and send a few investigators or whatever we have the staffing for going out to provide like the first responder type stuff or the patrols in areas like evacuation zones where a majority of the residents have been evacuated, or we'll actually help with the evacuations themselves. I've responded to numerous fires, the Camp Fire. we had the Car Fire here in Shasta County several years ago in 2018. Zog Fire. There's a bunch of fires. There's too many to name.
Yeah,
but
really,
we'll do that as well as we went down to Butte County a while back for the spillway, the Oroville Dam spillway issues, and we provided law enforcement support to those communities down in that area.
So you will respond wherever is need, just like all the other departments do that too, don't they?
Yes. Majority of them do if they have the staffing available. We also occasionally will respond out of state. There's been
really
a few different investigations that I've been involved in that have crossed state lines. A majority of them are like the child abduction cases where, you know, the child will be taken out of state. Recently, we had one taken out of country. Recently got that child back. So that was outstanding. The sheriff's office ran that case and then informed us of what was going on. But that was a case involving multiple law enforcement agencies as well as agencies in other countries.
Yeah. When you think of the crimes that you do regularly participate in, what are the nature of those crimes?
So when we conduct follow-up, usually we'll get a request from one of the prosecutors or someone on our legal side to assist with gathering evidence. I mean, they can range from homicides. I'd say a lot of our work involves like domestic violence, stalking cases, sexual assault, robbery. There's, I mean, usually it's the felony type cases, but then again, we also have the other side of it, the welfare side that we go out and work and assist the county with making sure people are reporting, you know, their income accurately, where they're living, and making sure that the funds are appropriate for the person, for the circumstances, and that they're not committing fraud or they're educated on it. We also provide a lot of that community outreach like I was talking about earlier.
Yeah, I want to talk to you a little bit more about that community outreach. But before I forget, the question I guess I wanted to ask you earlier and forgot till now. So essentially that sworn authority, you have training that you come into that position with. You're not just out of high school or a couple years of college. You go through an academy, don't you?
We do, yeah. We're actually, our position's required to have a post California Peace Officer Standards and Training Certificate. It gives us the certification to be peace officers in California. So we go through a post academy, which is several months long. And then once we do that, most of us have obtained jobs as a municipal peace officer or a deputy sheriff. And then we have a requirement that we have somebody with 5 years experience and preferably 2 years in investigative type work, carrying a caseload, working numerous cases. So a lot of our a lot of our investigators, when they lateral over from the other agencies, they bring in a huge amount of experience, depending on, you know, what they've worked in the past, the different positions that they've had. So we're super fortunate to gather those folks to supplement the knowledge and what we have to offer for our prosecutors and the community.
And who has oversight of your particular role? Is it the district attorney?
Yes. Yep. Okay. The district attorney is our department head.
Ah, okay. And in that department, do you know how many prosecutors there are?
Ooh, that's...
No. That's a district attorney question.
I believe we're around 30, but we're short-staffed. Yes. Up there on the prosecutor's side, yeah, as well.
I think that's kind of almost the norm anymore in government agencies, is being short-staffed. There's, yeah, such a huge demand, too. It's really difficult.
Yeah,
I think it's fascinating, you know, the diversity of the crimes you're working with. And I think it's so wise that you have people come in that have that investigative experience, because your whole focus primarily is investigations.
Yes. Yeah. We have, I would say the average experience that we have, even though we have that threshold or that minimum requirement, I would say the average investigator coming over or lateraling over to our office has in between 15 and 20 years experience. The extra help or part-time investigators retire, and then they're limited to working 900 hours per our county policy. But yeah, a majority of the investigators, and we have a younger department now still with that, you know, that 15 years or so experience. But yeah, we actually have quite a few people coming on that are, you know, still have that 15 years or more.
I'm wondering too, I always ask this when I have guests in, where did you grow up?
I actually was born and raised here in Shasta County.
There you go.
Born in Redding, lived here when I was young, went to elementary school for a couple of years, and then moved up to Shingletown. So I attended Foothill High School, Shasta College, and then left to go to State University. I went to Humboldt State and then came back after, you know, a couple of different careers that I went through.
What were the other careers?
So after Humboldt State, I started out working as a police cadet at Redding Police Department. So that was kind of the start of my law enforcement career. I worked for the state parks, for a company that would load the fire retardant in the air tankers out at the Redding Airport. So I would do that actually when I was going to school, and right out of high school, I went to work there. I was there for 5 years, and then state parks after I graduated from Humboldt State. Joined the Highway Patrol and then worked for a few different law enforcement agencies. When I was going to the Highway Patrol, still lived in Redding, but I'd commute down and stay in the academy during the week and then come home on the weekends. I actually started working at Orville Police Department, was there for almost 10 years, and had a house here and commuted, stayed down there during the week, and then decided some life-changing events happened and decided that it was time to be able to go home for lunch and, you know, help my wife out with different things.
I'm sure she appreciated that.
Yeah.
Like probably kids, huh?
Yeah. That's exactly what it was.
Yes. Good. Good.
So we made the decision to come up here, or for me to move up here. I joined the Shasta County Sheriff's Office, worked there for approximately or almost 5 years. And then I decided to transfer lateral over to the Shasta County District Attorney's Office. We had quite a few deputies that were leaving Shasta County Sheriff's Office to go to work there, and you know, talking to them and getting to know the folks and knowing some of the people that worked at the DA's office aside from those deputies really made me make that decision to move over. It was an, you know, excellent choice for family life, and you know, being able to go home for the most part on time and not have, you know, crazy hours of overtime and all the other commitments.
Yeah. Do you enjoy it?
I do. Yeah. I initially thought, I'll be honest, it was, I was a little concerned about not having enough work to do. And, I was always very active and I like staying busy and would pick the most busy beat and run all around. And then when I came over, it was, you know, not the proactive type work, but I I am definitely way more busy at the DA's office with a massive amount of work. I have never had a
dull day.
never a situation where I haven't had something to do. And a lot of times I've got a lot of stuff backed up that I'm just trying to get to.
I was going
to
say, you're probably in a situation where you never get caught up.
Unfortunately.
Yes. If you just joined us, this is a segment of Enjoy Exceptional Living. I am Lynn Fritz, your program producer and host. This program is in collaboration with Enjoy Magazine, KKRN 88.5 FM Community Radio, and myself. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist. We are here in conversation with Alex Hausman. He is the Chief District Attorney Investigator with the Shasta County District Attorney's Office. You know, two, I want you to think about, Alex, part of the reason I have people come in on the programs is not only to educate and inform the community, but it's also an opportunity for your department, in this case, to ask things from the community, like, here's a way that you can help us, or here's what you could do that would benefit us as an agency. So keep in mind, as we move through the program, that's an opportunity for you to make available sharing that sort of information. So we talked about the welfare fraud or different things that you're involved in. How about the outreach? Do you yourself do it, or someone in your department do outreach, or is it another aspect of the group?
Yeah, everybody in our division, and also other divisions within the DA's office, have the opportunities to do community outreach to educate the public. So we have a request form on our website that people can go to if they want to have us come in and provide a briefing on something that's important for them. Some examples of that would be, we do sometimes the bowling in schools. We'll go out to different agencies and provide training on, like, the FOCUS program, where that's a notification program where if something traumatic happens with children that law enforcement experience, they can notify the schools, the districts, not any sort of like confidential information, just the fact that the kid may or may not have been exposed to trauma. And then that way, when the child arrives at school, the school knows that there may have been something. This could be an example of like a car crash, a death in the family. Unfortunately, a lot of times it's domestic violence, sexual assault, other horrible crimes that happen, and it's a way for the kids to not have additional trauma when they arrive at school, and, you know, a way for the teachers to, you know, give them maybe a pass on things. Mm-hmm. If they didn't turn in their homework, there might be a reason why, and not, you know, provide further trauma to the child when they arrive at school. So we'll do that type of outreach, child abduction trainings to, like, the school districts or different schools. There's a majority. A large variety of outreach that we do. The EBT trafficking.
What's EBT?
It's the electronic benefits transaction. So the cards that people will apply for CalFresh or CalWORKs if they're on a limited income and receive money from the county or the state. We have an investigator that goes out and actually educates people on that, as well as in-home healthcare support services. So if somebody is a care worker for somebody, one of our investigators will go out, or a couple of them will go out and provide community education on, you know, what you can report, you know, how to prevent getting in trouble or violating the terms or the laws to prevent that issue. And then auto fraud, we have an investigator that will provide outreach on that, insurance fraud type stuff, real estate fraud. There's a number of different types of areas that we can provide that community outreach.
That's interesting. I didn't realize that the depth of that sort of investigations. I guess one of the questions I wanted to ask you about all of that, if a group, say a group says, we want to learn more about this, maybe it's Reading Chamber of Commerce, maybe it's service organization, is that something you would consider doing? They could call you up and say, hey, we have a group of 50 people and we want to learn about X.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. People can, again, they can go on our website. They can actually read about what the Bureau of Investigation does, or the other divisions within our agency. what we do, get more information on that, and then submit a speaker request or a community outreach request through our website, or certainly people can come in person. We're at 1355 West Street. It's the old Shasta County Library that was converted several years ago.
And, beautifully converted, by the way.
Yep. I remember going there as a kid.
Yeah, yes.
And then we can also, you know, field phone calls. The phone number is 530-245-6300. That's our main number. And yeah, certainly anybody's welcome to contact me directly or anybody else if they have questions.
How about your website address?
Yes, if you go onto the county website, the Shasta County government website, and just Google search that or type it in. I don't have it memorized off the top of my head, but you can certainly access the district attorney tab. It's all the different county departments.
Yes.
And select the district attorney tab, and then within that, there's different divisions that are divided up. We have our crime victim advocates, the prosecutors, the Bureau of Investigations, and you can read more online for sure.
Yes, there's lots of information about that. I did not realize that you would also do outreach regarding bullying, so it's good to know about that. I think that's an important aspect that you are working with. So we talked about, too, about your organizational structure and educational background. So I also wanted to ask you, too, to talk about, do you do court testimony?
Yes, we do. That's a large part of our duties within the Bureau. So
so it's more than a written document. You will actually go into court and testify at times.
Yes. Yeah. So we have several investigators that are considered or recognized by the courts as expert witnesses. So some of those, I guess some examples of that would be like the domestic violence. That's a lot of the expert testimony that we do, as well as I've done firearms expert testimony in the past, narcotics sales investigations, or drug endangered children type investigations, sexual assault, use of force, traffic collision reconstruction. There's a number of different things, and there's a lot more than that that we can come in and assist or provide support for the prosecutors.
You said use of force. What's that mean?
When a law enforcement officer uses force on somebody, so like the critical incidences involving law enforcement. We provide support for our prosecutors if there's a question or we need to provide more information. We receive a lot of training. Several of us are considered experts within that realm, and we go to like the force science training or training that provides education on reactionary times and the science behind, you know, how quick people can respond, law enforcement can respond to threats, perceive them, act, the response times, and how the body functions, how the body moves. So we receive a lot of training on that, and occasionally we'll provide support for that.
Yes. Do you typically, or would you ever be involved in an active shooter setting?
We certainly have trained in that, and if we hear, I was having that conversation recently with our members. If we hear that going on, then we are certainly responding. Anybody within our Bureau, sworn members, are going to be responding immediately, not asking for permission from me or taking up that time, just going directly directly to it as quick as they can get there. I've also had several conversations with allied agencies about that notification. We actually have an investigative tech that is assigned to monitoring radio traffic for specifically that and other, you know, critical type incidences or other issues that we need to be aware of. The fire response, a lot of times when these situations are happening, the dispatch center or the local agency doesn't have the time to contact us immediately and request assistance because they're dealing with a lot of different things. So we definitely will provide support when that situation happens.
You don't need a phone call. You're going.
Yeah.
Yes. I know in the past with like the car fire, a lot of the complaints you heard was about people not being notified. But the challenge with that scenario is how fast the fire was moving and to get out ahead of it so that people could be notified. So knowing that the agencies have the capacity to just go when they see the need,
yeah,
you know, I think that's important for people to know.
And yeah, we actually, several years ago, we started issuing Nomex to our investigators to protect them and keep them safe.
So what the is fire,
fire-resistant clothing.
Oh.
So we wear cargo pants that are fire-resistant. We wear our normal like leather-type boots and then a jacket that's fire resistant as well. It has a badge embroidered on it, so we're identified as a law enforcement officer. But we issued those as well as other stuff. A lot of us will grab like a chainsaw, some toe straps, ropes, that type of thing.
Yeah.
Fire shelters to throw in our cars in case that happens. I actually have a lot of experience with that locally with the Zog fire and other fires, the Dixie fire. I was assigned to those. I've done investigations. Some of them have commingled with other investigations throughout the state, the Kincaid fire, the Camp fire. I've definitely been involved in interviewing people on our local fire that related to the other fires. So unfortunately, there's very dangerous situations when those wildfires start, and it's very quick, rapidly evolving. And, you know, people really need to be educated and have a safety plan, a grab and go bag, a bag with supplies, their medical, you know, supplies, their important documents, just grab them and go and not second guess if they should be leaving or not. You know, before the car fire happened, I was always under the assumption that I would just stay at my house and take those risks and put out the fire. But after that, and with the tragedies involved in the car fire, that's definitely made me rethink my plan should that happen again or when it happens again.
Yes. Plus, I think what sometimes is an oversight is the gridlock when people are evacuating. It takes time to evacuate, I mean, traffic-wise.
Yeah.
And when it becomes really urgent and you can't predict where the fire is going to go, who would ever think you'd have a fire tornado in Shasta County? That's just unbelievable.
And that's why it's important when those alerts or, you know, when people start seeing the smoke, even if they're not getting the alert or the phone call, because occasionally that doesn't happen, as we know. It's important to immediately evacuate, to protect your family. And another thing that I run into on numerous working at a city agency as a deputy sheriff and at the DA's office, a lot of times when we go out and knock on doors, do the evacuation, a lot of times we'll find families with their kids there, and they may not understand the laws. And, you know, if they're an adult, they're allowed to stay there. If they have children there, then we are going to make sure those kids evacuate. And every situation that I've run into, I've been able to explain the law and the importance of, you know, if the kid stays there and they're allowing the kid to stay there, then potentially they could be charged with a crime, child endangerment, because it's a mandatory evacuation. So we usually educate the people very quickly and tell them that they can stay, but their kids need to leave. So,
See, I did not realize that. It makes sense because as a therapist, I always tell my clients not to have children in the waiting room. If they do have a child, you know, they're 13 or older, and so that they can take care of themselves. But it makes sense that a person as an adult has the right to stay if they so choose. I don't think that's wise, personally, because I've seen fire throughout my life, but certainly to protect children.
Yeah, a lot of times we'll ask them for their name and their date of birth and, you know, who their dentist is, so we can identify them later on, because unfortunately that happens, and it happens too often. So we'll obtain that information and then store it so we can confirm that they made it out of the fire, or we can, you know, identify them later if we have to. But yeah, it's super important to have that pre-planning and stuff ready to go, so you're not waiting and you just go, whether or not you're receiving a phone call.
Yes. And you know, Shasta County, we have very rural areas, and fire comes in from the Whiskey Town and the car fire into the main part of the city of Redding and parts of Shasta County where there were people in residence. But you think of Los Angeles and the areas down there that are, you know, metropolitan, and they're still struggling with fires, wildfires. Yeah. So it doesn't matter where you live today.
Yeah, I think a lot of it just depends when in our situation in the very urban areas, you know, once the fire reaches the urban area and you've got all the houses close together, storage sheds, once one house goes up, unless a fire engine is there or you have a substantial distance or clearance around your house, it's super hard to put those fires out. If your neighbor's house starts burning, then it's usually inevitable that your house will burn, unless, again, unless you have the clearance or you have a fire truck there and actively putting out the fire. But when resources are limited and there's not enough fire engines for,
yeah,
for each house, then unfortunately you have the
loss,
the chaos and the loss.
Yeah, yeah. And it's really hard to extinguish a fire when it jumps from house to house.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, neighborhood.
And we actually, we provide training to our investigators on how to deal with that when we're out in the evacuation areas, you know, fire behavior, fire patterns, where the areas are that you have the largest survivability rate, or the areas you need to go to prevent if the fire does come over. I've driven through numerous active fires throughout my career where fires burning on both sides. And unfortunately on the Zog fire, we had the fatalities where several people were burned to death.
Yes.
Just awful, awful situations.
Same with car.
Yeah,
that pass.
Campfire.
Yeah, it's horrible. Yes, unfortunately. If you just joined us, this is a segment of Enjoy Exceptional Living. I am Lynn Fritz, your program producer and host. This program is in collaboration with Enjoy Magazine, KKRN 88.5 FM Community Radio. Myself, I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist. We are here tuned in to Alex Houston. He is with the Shasta County District Attorney's Office, and his title is Chief District Attorney Investigator. I didn't realize you would go out on wildfires, and that makes sense that you would, because it's an emergent situation in that scenario. One of the questions I wanted to ask you too, you know, you mentioned Crime Victims Assistance Center, which is under the umbrella of the District Attorney's Office. So as investigators, do you interface with that department, or is that done differently through the prosecutor, perhaps?
Both. We do, though, on occasion, especially in like the domestic violence, the child sexual assault type stuff, we'll contact the advocate that's assigned to the victim or the survivor, and, you know, provide or obtain information on, you know, how the contacts have gone in the past, and just make sure that we're not exposing them to additional trauma if we can prevent it, having them go with us for contact or follow-up interviews. We'll do the forensic examinations at different locations. We'll do forensic examinations, the Children's Legacy Center and One Safe Place. We're doing the physical examinations there, or having a doctor do that, and we would sit in another room. But yeah, we interface with the crime victim advocates quite often, and really try to maintain that support network for the survivors, and let them know that, you know, we're prosecuting their case, or we're trying to obtain evidence. A lot of times we'll look back and see if there's other victims that, you know, experience similar circumstances with the same suspect, and then we'll go re-interview them. Sometimes that's years later.
That's interesting. Do you have any role when there's a restraining order in place and there's a question about whether the person's obeying the restraining order? Is that handled by other law enforcement agencies?
We do quite a bit of work related to restraining order violations. A lot of times in the domestic violence cases or family-related cases, we'll have the temporary or permanent domestic violence restraining orders, and we'll, on, you know, our follow-up interviews, we may find out that there was a violation that occurred, and that's a mandatory, you know, arrest type situation. So we'll dig into that. We'll get the facts, the evidence, and if we have the probable cause to make the arrest, then we'll contact the prosecutor, inform the prosecutor of the evidence that we obtained, the statement that was said, and then sometimes they'll either add it on, depending on where the case is at, or mm-hmm. file a new case if it's after the fact. So yeah, we definitely investigate those type of cases, the restraining order violations.
Yes. And, you know, as a licensed marriage family therapist, I've been in practice over 20 years. And the whole time I've been in practice, I've kept my relationship, and I'm on the list for therapists that provide therapy for victims of crime. And that's with the Crime Victims Assistance Center. It provides resources for and support for people that have been victims of crime. You have to apply for it, and they take you through a process, and you file a claim. If that claim's funded, you can get psychotherapy. Sometimes you get relocation dollars if it means you have to relocate for safety reasons. But it's a remarkable program, and I just encourage whenever I have someone call me as a client, prospective client, and they've been a victim of crime, I always ask them, have you tuned in to Crime Victims Assistance Center? Because it's a very, and it's statewide. Every county has part of that program. And so I think it's great that you're part of the investigative team that works with them.
Yeah, and they actually provide funding for a bunch of different things as well, like security doors, cameras. There's a bunch of different funding sources for depending on the circumstances and if the people qualify. So it's an excellent system statewide, like you said.
Yes.
And it definitely helps people with their safety.
And you know what's important too? Say there's a child that's a victim of the crime. There'll be funding for the caregivers of that child, you know, the parents mm-hmm. that are, maybe they weren't the direct victim, but it's really a remarkable program because from my personal perspective and professional perspective, real healing occurs when you can be in therapy and process that trauma so mm-hmm. that it doesn't follow you lifelong.
Right.
So I you mentioned one safe place, Children's Legacy Center. You know, you work on restraining orders sometimes. You know, you're very diverse in what you do. I'm impressed.
Yeah, we definitely have a lot of stuff. We also help with, you know, investigations involving federal, state, and other local agencies. We have a vast array of things that we do.
Yes, yes. Do you have any annual events that you show up at and participate in?
We do the fraud fair. There's numerous events that we show up to. The Think Pink. We have to take a minute to think about all of them. There's certainly a lot of community events that we will participate in. Our media folks run those programs, and then they'll send out emails to us asking for an investigator or two to accompany them to answer questions. I think that we have attended some of the job fairs and
that would make sense.
National Night Out.
Yes,
there's quite a few different events.
Yes, that's excellent. That's really excellent. And also, I wanted to ask you about what do you think the challenges are with your career?
I think, you know, a lot of it is the complexity of the investigations we get involved in and the, you know, how taxing that can be. I found when I was working a lot of domestic violence cases and going to the forensic interviews and then having those follow-up conversations with the survivor and sometimes their children, just that exposure, you know, listening to the horrible circumstance, much like you probably experience on a daily basis, getting that negativity, you know, in your life. Sometimes four different survivors per day that you're interviewing or following up on, and you definitely have to have an avenue, a way to relieve that stress and
process it.
And then it's hard, you know, for me, it's been trying to leave it at work and not bringing it home. But you know, there's been a lot of times where I've been, you know, thinking about things on the weekends, at home, you know, at night, and having trouble sleeping because you're thinking about the survivors or the victims and just the horrible, you know, situation they went through, and then relating that to your own family is hard.
Yes.
There's been a few cases that have stuck with me that I'll never forget for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I think that's first responders. That's a challenge for all. But when you work with the forensic investigations and you are seeing children interviewed that are victims of crime, it has a
innocent children.
Yeah, very intense exposure. It's hard. It's very challenging.
Yeah. Aside from that, the other challenges would be, like I started to mention, the complex investigations, and then going through that, we've worked several, you know, very complex, like the wire fraud cases, like I mentioned before, the real estate fraud. A lot of times we'll get a massive amount of paperwork, several boxes full of documents that we'll need to scan, review, search through, and find that evidence, and that can be extremely time consuming. But you know, that's the benefit of having numerous people within our bureau, that we can kind of divvy up some of that and provide those resources to them when needed. Yes. We're a very good team right now, and it's great to have the, you know, the response, or when we ask for help, people are always very willing to volunteer and provide that assistance to their investigators or technicians.
That's awesome. So let me ask you something specific. If I had a client, say it's a parent or a grandparent that's raising a child, and that child has somehow online gotten in touch with an adult and they're a minor, and that adult is trying to make contact with that minor for inappropriate relationship, is that something you investigate or might investigate, and they should be reporting it right to law enforcement first?
Yes, we do. We do investigate that type of crime. However, a majority of the time, we recommend report it directly to that law enforcement agency that has jurisdiction over that area where the crime occurred. They'd have that responsibility. Occasionally, we'll take investigations from the very beginning, but it really depends on a bunch of factors. A majority of the time, those cases need to start at the agency where the crime is occurring.
Yeah.
So we'll refer them
first.
If it hasn't been reported to a local law enforcement agency, a lot of times we'll refer them back or have them wait at our office if they're there, get the officer to take the initial and then forward it over. We don't want to, we want to make sure that we're cooperating with other agencies in a beneficial way, and we're not stepping on people's toes and,
yeah,
you know, doing
jurisdictions.
Right,
yeah,
right. Yeah. We actually have jurisdiction throughout the entire county, so it's a little bit different from like a Reading PD officer going out to the county area and, you know, doing their own investigation that didn't occur in the city. We can actually do that, but we don't. We're very limited in our staff compared to the other agencies. Again, a staff of 30 employees when we're at full staff versus, you know, 100 or a couple hundred.
Yes, that only makes sense. In your time in working in law enforcement, I'm wondering if there's any significant changes in what is illegal. Let's think of stalking. Have you witnessed any change in how it's perceived? When you first began your career, was stalking considered a crime?
Yes, it was. I can't remember, you know, I can't remember the changes. I do remember there were some changes, but I don't remember the time frame on those. Stalking cases were fairly rare when I was a new officer, and I probably only handled a handful of them at my 10 years when I first started, maybe 5 to 6 at the most. But then in the DA's office, we get a lot of those cases coming through where we're seeing the stalking charges, and a majority of the time it relates to domestic violence.
Yes, yes. Because I know as a therapist, I witnessed a change over the past 20 years where stalking was not as much of an issue as it is today. And I don't know if it wasn't because it wasn't reported, or if people, because of, you know, technology, you know, you can find people, you can
education, camera, awareness.
Yeah. But it's become, yeah, seems more prevalent.
Yeah. So. That's, I mean, I would definitely say, in addition to stalking, like the domestic violence, domestic violence, I think there's a lot more awareness for that. And there was a study, I believe it was in the UK, in maybe 2018, 2019, somewhere in there, where they found that 1 in 3 women were, it was unreported domestic violence. 1 in 3 women actually experienced domestic violence and didn't report it. And then 1 in 4 men, it was the same statistics. And yeah, the same with physical assaults, rapes. Stalking cases were half reported back then during that study, but I think a lot of it has to do with awareness and the importance of holding, for our office, holding people accountable, making,
yeah,
sure that, you know, they go to prison, they stay away, they don't reoffend or abuse additional people. And the stats are extremely alarming for domestic violence strangulation cases, where I remember going to a training a while back where it was, I believe it was the stats were 750% more likely after the first incident for the abuser to kill their partner after the first strangulation event if they didn't die on the first one. And when they provided us those stats, they said that there was some new studies that they were in the process of analyzing that that it was most likely more like 800 to 850 or more, that they had some gaps in people reporting on the statistics or issues with them. But that's an extremely alarming number.
Statistic, yeah.
Yeah, but I think there's a lot more awareness now for the domestic violence, stalking cases, strangulation.
Yes. I'm going to take a break for a station ID. And when I come back, I want to also ask if you have any role in interfacing with the grand jury. And we'll take it from there.
Okay.
If you just joined us, this is a segment of Enjoy Exceptional Living. I am Lynn Fritz, your program producer and host. This program is in collaboration with Enjoy Magazine, KKRN 88.5 FM Community Radio, and myself. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist. We are here in conversation with Alex Houston. He is the Shasta County District Attorney Office Chief District Attorney Investigator. And we've been talking about what his agency is involved in and all the many, many things that I did not know you were up to. So I'm wondering, because you'll often hear people talk about the grand jury and they're part of the decision making about whether a case may be moving forward with prosecution. Do you have any working relationship with them?
You know, I personally don't. It's kind of a rare thing, or at least the time that I've been at the DA's office. We certainly have that ability to do that. We also do occasionally investigations for the county or for different agencies. Sometimes we'll do internal investigations for other agencies if there's, you know, a conflict or something. But the grand jury is something that I haven't personally been a part of, and I think it's been a while since our office has been assisting with conducting those investigations.
Yeah, I was just kind of curious. So I also want to pause before the other questions I have for you. Is there anything that you can think of that the community can be participating in a way to support the district attorney's investigators department or in crime, you might even say, helping with crimes? I guess it's see something, say something.
Yes.
It's one of those things.
Yes.
Call in. Don't just ignore it.
Yeah, I guess I would recommend that, you know, for those people listening out there that, you know, unfortunately, jury subpoenas are a lot of people don't like getting those, but they provide an important role for the community to provide that input and make a decision that will potentially affect somebody's life for the rest of their life. So, you know, if people receive the jury summons or they're subpoenaed for court, we would really appreciate that you comply with those. They are, you know, super important for prosecution and getting people to actually attend if they're a witness, to provide, you know, the evidence or the facts of the case of what they witnessed or what they were aware of or what they saw. If one of our investigators is out and leaves a business card on somebody's door to call them, or they contact somebody, please assist us in providing that contact and reach back out to us or talk to us and, you know, answer our questions. We would greatly appreciate that. And that will support, you know, us locating additional facts and bringing those facts to the prosecutors.
Yes. And, you know, sometimes people will find a business card and they'll go, well, I don't know anything. It doesn't hurt to call. And when you talk with them, you may say, I don't know. And that's okay.
Yeah.
But it lets them know that lead has been resolved or that inquiry.
Yeah. And I think sometimes people, from my experience, they don't want to be involved, or they're concerned about retaliation. People can also contact the number on the card, and they don't necessarily have to identify who they are, but say, you know, I was contacted. I think I know what this is about, and then provide that input, or they can report stuff anonymously as well, and maybe that information will develop into identifying other people that might know. But the importance of our office holding people accountable and preventing additional crimes, victims, is huge, and
yes,
we definitely want to serve justice and protect the community.
And, you know, when I've had conversations with colleagues and clients, you know, people will complain about crime. And that's why I say, when you see something, say something. That's a way that we can participate in helping crime not be successful.
Yes.
And being part of a jury is part of the legal process to have that crime reviewed and a sentence given. So instead of avoiding it, we can be part of it, move forward and be part of it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think it's important. So also, are there other things that you are involved in, collateral or maybe with other nonprofit organizations?
Yeah, I have, for collateral assignments, I've been the department rangemaster for a while now, and, you know, involved in training officers in the use of firearms and other tools.
So a rangemaster. So yeah, what does that mean?
So we have firearms to protect ourselves or other people, and we go through qualifications. Some of it's mandated, but we go out to the range and we shoot a lot, and we provide input. Range masters or instructors will provide input to those investigators to keep them safe and proficient in their use of their firearms, and make sure they're, you know, accurately hitting their targets and, mm-hmm. you know, doing things to increase their survivability on, you know, encounters where somebody's trying to hurt them or hurt other people. So,
yeah. So you're part of that training to keep them safe.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, obviously, well, I mentioned earlier the wildfire stuff, but with a resolution of the Dixie fire and the Zog fire, we had a stipulated agreement. Unfortunately, it resolved on the civil side instead of the criminal side, but we have meetings with a consultant that was appointed by the court as a result of the Dixie resolution and the Zog fire resolution involving PG&E. So I attend those meetings and make sure that, you know, we're identifying issues or asking questions and making sure that PG&E is complying with, you know, increasing that safety, which we've seen, you know, a lot of success, or there's been a lot of positive changes in Shasta County since those fires, and we want to maintain that forward momentum and make sure that they're complying with the law and that they're doing what they're telling us or saying they should be doing.
And for that, can you explain to someone who may not know what it is you're keeping PG&E accountable for, as an example?
Complying with the public resource code and the public utility code. With the campfire, there were actually two fire ignitions on the campfire. One was the C-hook on a transmission line. Another was a vegetation contact with a distribution line. With the Zog fire, same thing. The Kincaid fire, another failure. So in wind events, or maybe not even wind events, there will be an issue where there's not the right clearance, or there's a defective tree. In the Zog fire, there was a defective tree that was identified a couple of years prior, and it wasn't re-identified by the subsequent patrols, ultimately failing and killing several people. So we're, you know, we want to make sure that they're complying with the law and they're maintaining those required clearances for vegetation, as well as maintaining their infrastructure and making sure that it's good. They're doing a lot of undergrounding right now in Shasta County, actually in a lot of the communities, and making a lot of positive improvements. The enhanced safety settings, you know, that's something where a line might sense a fault and then immediately shut off a segment. That's been, I think that's been very successful in the last year or so. So just, yeah, maintaining the, making sure they're complying with the law.
Yeah, that makes sense. So really you're making sure that the clearance that's for lines going through an area, that they're following through and making sure that that's transpiring.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I sometimes hear people struggle with shutdowns of power when it's really windy, because PG&E does that, but they do that to prevent wildfire.
Correct.
Yeah. So it's a
big thing that we've learned here. And hopefully as they put more things underground, there's going to be less need to shut things down.
Yeah, yeah. Unfortunately, in the rural areas and terrain and, you know, how many rocks are in the ground in different circumstances, rivers, it's hard to underground the entire infrastructure.
Yeah.
It's very expensive. But, you know, taking these safety protocols and implementing them is super important. And I know that a lot of people don't like I certainly don't like the shutoffs, but they definitely prevent loss of life.
Yeah, and that's what matters, huh?
Yep.
Yeah, especially if we're the person that's impacted directly, it's really hard. Yeah. Other things that you do, aren't you involved with the Peace Officers Association?
I am, yeah. I've been on the Shasta County Peace Officers Association for a few years now. I started out as the vice president and then took over as president a few years back. The Shasta County Peace Officers Association consists of a board of directors of seven people. It's a cooperative law enforcement training facility, mainly a range, rifle range, handgun, a couple of handgun ranges, and a training grounds, or we call it a clubhouse, but a structure with a couple of large TV screens. And we utilize that for maintaining proficiency with our law enforcement officers, state, local, federal officers, where it provides an outlet, it provides a location for training, for conducting classroom training and different things, maintaining that proficiency with firearms. And a little bit of the history with the Shasta County Peace Officers Association, it's located out on the west side of Redding, the Mary Lake area. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. a lot of people hear the gunshots and they're not happy with that. We actually limit the hours, so we're not shooting like all throughout the night. Even though we can, we don't. We cut it off at 10 o'clock, but there's no restriction for us out in the county because it's located in the county jurisdiction for shooting 24/7. But we try to be a good neighbor and have done a lot of preventive measures to dampen or limit the sound. But the historical, or the way that this nonprofit started, was back in the 1950s. Lou and Ida Record donated the land to the newly formed Shasta County Peace Officers Association. And the intent was to manage and enhance the continued local law enforcement training efforts.
Makes sense.
So, you know, so Lou was a former captain with Redding Police Department and retired over 50 years ago, and actually 70 years ago. And him and his wife donated the land, and since then it's been a training facility for local law enforcement. We also provide we give back to the community. We provide donations to a bunch of different nonprofits, the Redding Police Explorers, the Shasta County Sheriff's Office Explorers, Boy Scouts, 4-H, California Horsemen's Association, Redding Tactical Officers Association, the NorCal Think Pink Car Show, Whiskeytown Environmental School. We provided monetary donations for a lot of different nonprofits as part of giving back to the community.
You're highly engaged in community.
Yeah.
I want to thank Alex Houston, and I want you to know, Alex, I need to have you come back soon to talk more about what's going on, because you guys are very, very invested in community.
Sure.
He is from the Shasta County District Attorney's Office. He is the Chief District Attorney Investigator. I've learned a lot from you. And thank you for all you do to make our community safe and to help with fighting crime.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and thank you for what you do. It's very important work what you do.
Thank you. I want to encourage Alex, myself, and our listeners. We want to make this day and every day a day to enjoy exceptional living. Thank you for joining us.